Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the 90s, the ag giant Monsanto took the herbicide Roundup, developed crops that could survive it while weeds withered, and remade much of American agriculture. The eternal war against the weed was won, they said. A little genetics, a lot of chemical, and weeds were done. But now the weeds are coming back, evolved and impervious, choking millions of acres of farmland. It's quite a story. This hour on Point, chemicals, genetics, evolution, American farming, and the rise of the superweed. Joining me first today from Lawrence, Kansas, is Anita Dilley, agronomist and professor of weed ecology at Kansas State University. Anita Dilley, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom.
This is a really interesting story for many on the outside looking in, and for an awful lot of former farmers, I'm sure it's a gripping story. I grew up in the days on a farm in the days before Roundup. We used to call it walking beans, just mile after mile in the soybean fields, chopping the weeds out by hand. Tell us what happened with Roundup, and then in the 90s with the Roundup Ready seeds that changed so much of American agriculture, Anita.
Roundup is a product from Monsanto, as you've introduced. The active ingredient in that is glyphosate, so mm-hmm. Some people may hear it that way. And in the 70s, it was introduced as a herbicide that would control weeds non-selectively, but it also killed the crops. And so it was used in certain situations in order to manage weeds where there was no crop growing, so before we planted right. Or after planting. Mm-hmm. And then, as you introduced in the 90s, they were able to develop genetically modified corn, soybeans, crops that could tolerate applications of Roundup sprayed over the top, and definitely did a great job on managing all the weeds. It was a very straightforward program that farmers could easily adopt. So before we knew it, after 1996, when the soybeans were first introduced, mm-hmm. In 2000, and in this last 10 years, we've just seen almost 95% of our soybean acres, probably 80% of our corn acres, same for cotton, be predominantly Roundup ready crop varieties.
So genetically modified, introduced by Monsanto, they would survive the Roundup, so the weeds were easy to put down. You just spray everything with Roundup, the crops would flourish and be off to the races. But it meant a lot for the way cultivating was done or was not done. I mean, there were big changes in terms of tilling and handling the fields. Anita.
Definitely. Especially in Kansas, one of our challenges in growing crops is to have enough moisture available mm-hmm. and also to keep the soil on the ground instead of blowing up in the air with wind erosion and water erosion. And so no-till, the concept of not having to till our fields and being able to plant directly into the stubble, really became much easier to do when we had Roundup that we could spray anytime.
I would go home and really not recognize the Midwest in the springtime because nothing had been plowed. Just the fields just left as they were, and they'd come along and poke the seeds straight in on top of the old stubble, as you say. But that had huge and positive ramifications for soil erosion, for topsoil loss. It didn't blow away.
Definitely. It was just a huge advantage to keep the soil where it is. We've lost a lot of topsoil, degrades the soil, and so then our crops are not as productive. So these were definite steps ahead.
But the flip side was that, of course, evolution goes on, and there would be outliers that would survive the Roundup. And I guess gradually those have mounted in volume. Now we've got horseweed and pigweed and more that Roundup, doesn't kill anymore.
Correct. Weeds are so adaptable. Their genetic variation is so wide that, a few survive. They produce their seeds and spread a little bit at a time. And eventually, if you keep, you know, selecting, we'll call it selection pressure, you keep selecting for those ones that are going to survive, kill the ones that are not. And eventually, a farmer realizes, oh, I'm not getting good weed control anymore. I've got all these plants that are surviving. And then we've determined through tests in the greenhouse and in the field that, yes, they are genetically resistant now, just like the crops, to Roundup.
Now this can sound like maybe a small thing for a small patch gardener, but if you get this into industrial scale, you get big weeds there. I mean, it's already hitting in cotton in the southeast. It's a big deal already. Getting up into Tennessee, into soybeans, and everybody's assuming it'll be a problem for corn at some point. I mean, farmers can't just let weeds take over, or what happens to their yields, their crops, Anita?
Yeah, there's no question. The whole reason, you know, we try to grow crops. We want only the crop in the field. The weeds can cause anywhere from, you know, a few weeds can cause 5, 10% yield loss by the end of the year if they're uncontrolled, through total complete crop yield loss. And so there's no question, one of the dominant things that growers need to do is manage their weeds in order to ensure that they've got some production.
Because we've got some huge monocultures and we've got production agriculture, whatever we do gets done on a huge scale. People are talking about bringing back, one, more labor-intensive tilling and cultivation to get the weeds out, and two, bringing back some of the herbicides that were heavily used before Roundup, like 2,4-D, which was part of Agent Orange. These are pretty serious herbicides themselves.
Yeah, there's a number of tools. I guess I always come back, we need to make it an integrated system. So we don't lose the Roundup, but we do need to think of what are some of those tools we've used before. But just to clarify, 2,4-D was not really the Agent Orange issue. And so I don't want to put those two together to get us into trouble. But 2,4-D is still really an awesome, effective herbicide. For example, in Kansas, half our land is pasture, and still an important plant to be able to get some of the broadleafs out of our grass crops in order to feed our cattle. There are some other products that we need to think about using. Roundup was nice because you could wait for the weeds to come up and then spray them. And we have some other products that we can put on the soil to get the weeds as they're germinating and starting to come through. And so if we can knock these weeds at a couple different times in their life cycle, that makes a big difference in being able to manage them. And so we've got some older products that we need to, that are still incredibly effective, need to be price effective for our growers, that we can introduce and still use. And we've also got some companies that still have some new products that they're working on, that may be, you know, equally environmentally friendly, still low dose, that are equally effective on these herbicides. They just go after the plant in a different way.
Some old products, some pretty strong ones, and maybe some old ways. I want to turn to a farmer who's dealing with this himself. Eddie Anderson joins us from Dyersburg, Tennessee. Has been using Roundup and Roundup Ready seeds for a long time, but like others across the country, in Tennessee not least, he's been facing what's being called super weeds that are Roundup resistant. Eddie Anderson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What have you seen showing up, and when did it start, Eddie?
We've seen these super weeds, and mare's tail is one that you haven't mentioned that we have a problem with here, and that grows up tall, and it looks kind of like a mare's tail. But we started noticing the resistant mare's tail. That was the first weed about 6-7 years ago.
And how big a problem has it become? Is Roundup working for you at this point or not?
Well, the Roundup is not working anymore, no, Tom. There are several weeds, as you mentioned, the pigweed, the pigweed, the horseweed, the nutgrass, yellow nut sage. It doesn't even doesn't really do much except on grasses.
Remind us of how it felt in the 90s when Roundup was working really well. It sort of felt like a new age as far as I could tell from farmers, Eddie.
Well, I could go home at night when they first came out with the genetically modified seed, and you sprayed Roundup over the top of everything, mm-hmm. and you cleaned your crop, and you didn't have to plow, and I could go home at night and get a good night's rest. And now when I go home, I'm thinking about what can I do to take these super weeds out. We're not plowing like we used to. I don't mm-hmm. even own a row crop cultivator anymore.
Wow.
Don't know where I could buy one.
Did you think in the 90s that we were all done with weeds? That was history.
We wanted to think so, but I can remember back years ago we used a lot of trifluralin, treflan, and 30 years ago, and we used so much of it then. Now, it was a soil-applied herbicide, that did a really good job with pigweeds back then and grasses, seedling grasses. And we use so much of it that the grasses and the weeds become immune to trefflin, and so we had to get away from that. And so it's Mother Nature taking her place.
And what's happening with crop yields, Eddie, as these some of these superweeds, as you call them, move in?
Well, we have managed so far, Tom, to keep our yields up and spend a lot of extra money on some old herbicides and some old ways, old techniques of farming. And as a matter of fact, I had a crew of choppers last year that went into a field and chopped these Palmer pigweeds out.
By hand?
By hand, yes. And that is so expensive, Tom. We cannot afford that anymore.
I mean, that's very old school. Can we have the kind of American agricultural production that we've become used to if people are back out there with hoes and machetes? I mean, I did that as a kid, but that's a while back.
We're in a dilemma. All of agriculture is, especially here in West Tennessee, and we're in the Mississippi River Delta. And we're in that when the floodwaters come out, it takes seeds from different farms and deposits them on your farm, so you have no control over that. And we're just we're in a dilemma. We don't know what to do. We're trying all the. I am researching myself on my farm, different herbicides, different chemicals, soil applied, whatever, trying to come up with a solution to the problem. And I really think Monsanto has let the American farmer down.
Let's let them down. We'll talk about it. Eddie Anderson, we wish you luck, and we're very grateful for your time today. Good luck with this year's crop.
Thank you, Tom.
Anita Dilley's joined us from Lawrence, Kansas. She's an agronomist and professor of weed ecology there at Kansas State University. We're also joined right now from Washington by Doug Gurian-Sherman, senior scientist for food and environment at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Doug, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you see going on in this story? Americans think a lot about organic farming, about what's in their food, about what's on the fields, the whole environment these days. And then along comes a story like this, which kind of shakes up everybody a little bit. Farmers, as we just heard, really, you know, going in circles sometimes trying to figure out what to do. And food consumers watching and wondering what it all means for them. What do you see happening here?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for the farmers because they're struggling to make a living. And it's a tough road to hoe, no pun intended. But I think the whole situation, you know, we really need to look deeper than just alternating chemicals and switching some chemicals for others. I think really this is indicative of a way of thinking about agriculture that works against biology and nature instead of with it. And, you know, we really can do better than thinking of an agricultural system, which is really an ecosystem, as if it were a factory of some sort. And so what I mean by that is, you know, you're trying to impose a preconceived idea of how best to grow crops productively, and our agriculture has been historically very productive. That's, I think, been the upside of it. On biology, which has its own ideas, so to speak, about how best to produce plants. And you know, I was a little dismayed to hear discussions about integrated systems, you know, referring, unless I misunderstood, only to alternation of different kinds of herbicides. This is something that biologists have referred to as the pesticide treadmill for decades now. And what ends up happening is we burn out one chemical. And this has happened before with insecticides and fungicides and herbicides, and then just switch to another chemical, which may be even more toxic. You mentioned the case with 2,4-D. Dicamba is another one. Mm-hmm. Paraquat is another herbicide that farmers are going back to. And there's a number of others, as Professor Dilley suggested. But, you know, some of these herbicides, you know, certainly have impacts on the environment. Not that Roundup doesn't. But, you know, it's generally considered less harmful than many other herbicides. It tends to break down more quickly. But, you know, herbicides like 2,4-D have been, you know, at least associated with something called endocrine disruption in animals, in animal testing, possibly in people. And certainly other herbicides, like the widely used herbicide on corn, atrazine, is banned in many countries. There's lots of data that coming out on that, that it actually changes the sex of animals, frogs, for example. And so just going back to those old herbicides is not really what, you know, the technology of genetic engineering or what agriculture in general should be aiming for. There are systems that are highly productive that really can, if with especially with a little more research to make them more practical and develop the specifics of them, can be as or more productive than agriculture now, and yet greatly reduce, or in the case of organic, largely eliminate the use of most of these chemicals and the huge environmental impacts that agriculture generally has. I think we have to keep in mind that while it's great that we're productive with our agriculture, agriculture has some of the biggest environmental impacts on the planet, including, you know, we're looking at the Gulf right now and the terrible situation with the oil spill. Every year we have what's called a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Even before that, from all the stuff coming down the river.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it's coming from the runoff from fields. And while there have been some improvements over the decades, they're not nearly enough. And that dead zone grew through the 80s and 90s and has been even growing somewhat in this last decade. And, you know, it impacts our fishing. And it has to be remembered that that is one of several hundred dead zones around the world. Not all of them caused by agriculture, or largely by agriculture. There are other things that are contributing to it.
Doug, I want to get yeah. to Anita Dilley on integrated systems and alternatives to what's been out there for the last 10, 20 years. But I guess my first question for you is, just at the scale of modern agriculture, I mean, what do you do? I grew up with a hoe, but it's hard to picture enough hoes and enough hands in American fields to keep the weeds at bay with any kind of the crop levels that we've become accustomed to.
Right. Well, you know, for example, you know, organic agriculture does tend to use, you know, considerably more labor than, you know, what we would often call conventional agriculture. Mm-hmm. But there are other systems that are, you know, part of the way, let's say, or a substantial part of the way towards organic. Some of them, for example, called low external input systems that have been showing tremendous promise. And they use, a sophisticated understanding of how crops and weeds and pests all interact. In other words, working with the biology of the system. One of the main things is using long crop rotations. So instead of, as we're doing mostly in the Midwest, driven largely, by the way, by taxpayer-subsidized subsidies, corn and soybeans, one rotated after another, which feeds the weed cycles and the pest cycles, because anything that's adapted to those crops is just encouraged by their constant growth on huge, huge acreage. Instead of doing that, if you alternate it with, say, adding alfalfa, which is an important forage crop, and small grains like wheat and oat and others, you can keep up the profitability of the farm, or at least there's indications that can be done, possibly with some increase in labor compared to now, but a huge reduction in chemicals. Weed pressures, you know, go way down, but some of the studies out of Iowa State suggest, for example, that, you know, we can reduce herbicide use by 80% or more. We can reduce nitrogen use, which is, you know, the big cause of the dead zones, such as in the Gulf
Fertilizer,
of Mexico,
yep.
by 75% or more. The use of cover crops, which can add, you know, usable nitrogen to the soil and reduce erosion, and also have a positive effect on weed growth. There's a number of things that use biology, but we're not encouraging them enough because we have, I think, this fixation on chemicals and genetic engineering, which, you know, have their place and have, you know, been effective in many ways, but are really only a small part of the picture.
Running out on the Roundup front right now. Hold that thought, if you would. I want to get to Anita Dilley and a couple of calls here. Let's get a call. James in Leicester, Vermont. James, you're on the air with Anita Dilley and Doug Gurian-Sherman.
Thank you, Tom. I'm an organic farmer from Leicester, Vermont. And the farmers in Vermont, of course, as most people know, are shrinking, they're disappearing at a phenomenal rate. We're down to fewer than 1,000 dairy farms in Vermont right now. And the principal reason for this is overproduction. And the principal reason for overproduction is that the farmers are hooked on herbicides and artificial fertilizers that drive production, and yet they want to use more. So this news that Roundup is allowing weeds to grow is the best news for American agriculture to come down the pike in years. And the farmer who called up a little while ago and said he didn't know what he would do about finding a mechanical row cultivator, we use them all the time. And the best news of all would be...
You'll come along after you've planted when things have come up, and you'll actually drive down the rows and mechanically hoe out the weeds, in effect.
We do it the way it's been done for mm-hmm. centuries. Chemical agriculture has only really been prevalent for 50 years, and that just happens to be coincidence with the disappearance of 80% of American farms.
But, James, what about the kind of food supply that Americans are accustomed to and the whole industry, the economics depend on? You know, very, very large. Can you do that with organic farming?
The price of food must go up because the savings that have come, the cheap food that conventional agriculture produces, externalizes its costs into the lake. Lake Champlain is teetering on the brink of ecological collapse, mostly because of the herbicides and the fertilizers that farmers apply to their fields, which then wash into the rivers and into the lake. So society can make a choice. We can either pollute our environment and continue to be dependent upon oil. By the way, herbicides and fertilizers are all dependent upon oil. They're all made from petroleum.
Yep.
And as we run out of petroleum, we are going to have more people in the field with hoes if we want to eat.
James, I appreciate your call very much. Anita Dilley, you've been very patient there in Kansas. What are you thinking as you listen to these different perspectives on what we're now up against as Roundup effectiveness declines?
Yes, there are lots of challenges out there, and my brain is flowing all over the place trying to think of reactions and how to respond. I agree with Doug in the sense of our integrated weed management strategies and other things that we need to incorporate into the whole system for producing crops, producing animals. Our challenge is we've got fewer people that are interested in going back to the farm and doing some of that labor, doing some of that work. We've got a very different society than we did 50, 60 years ago. And so, you know, if we could do organic, wow, that would be fantastic. But we can't find the people to do that.
What if the price of food goes up? That won't be fun for anybody, but could it push economic incentives back up through the food chain and make that work pay?
There are no questions. If farmers can be productive and it happens to be an organic system that they can be productive in, they will go for it. And we have a number of producers across the state of Kansas that are organic producers on a pretty good size scale that produce grain crops. Challenges are, you know, all through the line in the sense of production, marketing, and getting it to the users, getting it into the grocery stores. But yeah, we have interest in cheap food, finding good deals. But that's just within the U.S. We also need to think how we play in the whole world situation and the need to produce as much food as we can. So,
recent years. We saw food shortages. I mean, can we globally? You know, our farmer James in Vermont is very articulate and plugged in here, talking about the externalized costs of large scale production agriculture, but we've got a very large population on this planet. Can we feed it organically?
Not unless we get a whole bunch of people back to the farm. I don't think we can in some ways, or we're still working on those ideas. There's a lot of principles that the organic farmers have figured out without the use of chemicals that we need to also plug in and see how we can do that on a larger scale, because that's where our farmers are right now on very large acreages and trying to manage it.
Here's a lot of comments from Facebook. Kelly says, downsize, go organic, hire people to weed. Haley says, avoid monocultures, bring back the family farm. McMillan says, with so many people out of work, the solution seems simple. Hire a new generation of farmers to weed. We already started this transition in Sonoma County beyond organic. What do you say to these correspondents, Anita?
It is just so hard to find people that are willing to do that kind of work. I did it as a kid, just like you described, mm-hmm. Tom, mm-hmm. earlier, and probably one of the reasons why I got into weed science and trying to figure out how not to have to be out there anymore. It was a lot of work, a lot of hot summers, and the kind of research I do, I'm still out there trying to do it, so I haven't quite figured it out. But, you know, the family farm's important. I like that comment from Facebook. That's definitely one way to do it. If we can find a way to support the family farm, we get a little smaller, and able to manage the land that we have. I like the idea of mixed crops, not the monoculture, but how do we really encourage diversity in the crops, that we do rotate, that we have systems where we're still producing what we need, but change it up so that, you know, not all 640 acres, for example, in Kansas is all corn, but that we can block it off into groups. And so through, you know, education of the students that we have that are going back to the farm. Many of the ones that I have in class now have not heard of anything else but Roundup, and we continue to have to remind them there are other things out there. These are the cultural practices. How do we plant our crops to be more competitive?
I mean, size itself is an issue. I'm reading here a farmer in Arkansas with 8,000 acres who's got pigweed all over his farm. Now, Roundup won't touch it, and he's saying, you know, it's nerve-wracking because the scale of his farm makes getting in there organically or physically really difficult. When you've got 8,600 acres, this is Ron Holthouse in Osceola, Arkansas, it's kind of overwhelming. Let's get a call. Andover, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got to say, I agree with Anita and some of the Facebook people. I think that this is, the solution is pretty evident. The farms are too big. And they aren't an industry. They're agriculture that relies on life. Life doesn't necessarily conform to human will. I understand that it is challenging to, you know, come back to a, you know, a sort of organic or a traditional method, but I think we might be able to say relatively soon that this 50-year experiment of, like, high-intensity chemical farming may just have failed.
How much more are you prepared to spend for your groceries, Chris? I mean, here's a comment from Yar who says, we're hypocrites. We scream against immigrant labor but want cheap food. That's the nexus of expanded chemical use. He says, my grandfather sold corn for $4 a bushel in 1950. That would be over $50 in today's dollars. That would be much more expensive food, Chris.
Yeah, and I understand that. But I guess I agree with the other Facebook comment that said, you know, with so many people out of work, the answer seems evident. And there's a lot of, you know, land here in the southern tier of New York State. There's land that goes begging. There's land that was farmed productively for, you know, nearly a century that's now all in weeds.
Maybe farm it again in a different way. Chris, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if I can be as eloquent as James from Vermont was earlier, but the experiment has failed. How many more wake-up calls do we need? Watch the documentary Food, Inc., and you cannot come away with any other thoughts than Monsanto is an evil, evil, evil corporation. As Barbara Kingsolver says in her book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, all we have to do is, if Americans will get to the point of eating 10% from organic and local, the big the Monsantos and the corporate food, the Cargills and all those, they will fail, and something good will replace them. It may be painful, but it's unsustainable. It's a failed experiment. It can't go forward. So for anyone listening out there who's not watched the documentary Food, Inc. and wants to be utterly convicted, watch that movie, and then you will see that Monsanto is a soulless company.
Jim, we've got it. Doug, do you think that the country's – I mean, farmers are going to have to make some changes here. Do you think the American consumers are ready for some changes?
Well, there certainly has been a growth in interest in more nutritious food and people, you know, that have the means willing to pay more for food to get tastier and more nutritious food. So, we right now pay a very small percentage, about 9% or so of our incomes for food. And, you know, we have to remember that people are not interested in, as some poor people in the world are kind of forced to do, to eat nothing but corn. So we're certainly willing to pay more for food that we, you know, think is more nutritious, safer,
Doug, stand by if you would. We have to take a short break here. Doug Gurian-Sherman and Anita Dilley in Kansas. Listeners, we're talking about a new generation of superweeds and what they mean for American agriculture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Anita, on the Monsanto front, I'm a little confused about where they're headed here. I saw a story a few days ago saying they're going to help fight the spread of superweeds. Then I saw a story just last week of the head of Monsanto saying they're going to shrink because they've been losing market share to a generic Roundup out of China. And they've got these super weeds. They're going to shrink their crop protection segment. Their stock is way down. He said, essentially, we've left the chemical space. This is Monsanto CEO Hugh Grant at an investors conference in New York. They've taken some big hits on the stock price side here. Is Monsanto still going to still be in the game, Anita? Is it clear?
I believe Monsanto will still be in the game, but they're playing it from a different perspective. So instead of providing the herbicide as much as they have in the past, they mm-hmm. are really focusing on the seed trait side. So the development
the
of
genetics.
The genetics, exactly.
And but so what can you do on that side? I mean, a weed isn't just overshadows or, you know, pushes out a plant, right? So you can't make it genetically resistant to weeds.
Not to weeds, but what weeds do is cause stresses. They're plants just like the crop trying mm-hmm. to grow with the same resources. So some of the, and it may not be just Monsanto, but other companies are looking at how can we make, say, corn more tolerant to drought. So if it can handle drier conditions, the weeds may take longer to adapt to those conditions. So our crop is more competitive against the weeds that are also trying to grow in really dry environments. And so those are other things. So looking for varieties that are out there that are able to grow in the dry, how can we take advantage of that information and put it into a crop variety that we would release? So I believe Monsanto is looking more at the genetics, a little less at the chemical side of things, and letting the other companies, as you said, with Roundup off patent and able to be produced by many other companies, mm-hmm. they'll produce the generic glyphosate product.
I want to bring another farmer in here, if I may, Anita and Doug. Mm-hmm. Rob Joslin joins us from Yellow Springs, Ohio. He's got 950 acres that he farms there, planting soybeans and corn near Sydney, Ohio. He's president of the American Soybean Association, 22,000 members, 28 states. Rob Joslin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
We heard earlier from a farmer, Eddie Anderson, in Tennessee, who's got all kinds of problems right now with pigweed down there, and it's, you know, driving him a little crazy. It was a lot easier in the 90s when Roundup was working. Now it's not working so well. Is that affecting your fields yet, Rob?
No, I've been lucky. We do not have much pigweed up in my area, but I do very, very clearly, and it's been addressed quite a bit. I hear strict crop rotations. I also make sure I rotate chemistries. And I think the message here that your listeners need to remember is our industry will adapt and good managers will adapt. They have, and I was very pleased. Eddie did one thing. It's probably a last-ditch resort in a labor-intensive situation is you go out and mechanically address the resistant mm-hmm. weed. And I think that's one thing. We do have multiple ways to address this resistance that not just glyphosate, but we do have in the industry.
Do you think it's going to be mainly new or old herbicides, mainly genetics, you know, to mess some more with the genetics of the crops to make them more capable? Or is it going to be some organic path, Rob?
How about can I take all of the above? Because I think it will be all of the above. Farmers will use the tools that they need, and I think that's what we've had. I've been farming since I started in 1974, so I have a few years under my belt. I grew up on my farm. Mm-hmm. It's a single-family farm. My wife and I take care of this. And I think our industry will look for addressing the problems we have. One of the things, I think it's been addressed a few times, but very clearly, the UN, United Nations, says within 40 years we have to double our food production in this world. And that's a significant undertaking. But to do that, we have to do it with less fuel, less water resources, land mass is shrinking, and have less environmental footprint. Less impact on the environment.
What about labor? I mean, I grew up on a farm, seventh generation now on that farm in Illinois, but there were a lot more hands in the field in the summer than there are now. Now my cousin does it, you know, with some big machinery and a few tanks of Roundup, and it became very easy, not even plowing, relatively easy, I should say. But, you know, is there a mismatch between the labor we may need here and the way our labor is arrayed in this country now?
If a labor is available, I'm sure the industry will take it. I do think in the United States, though, that labor, we do not have a labor pool. Some other countries do. I have been in China. I've been out there watching hand hoe the corn. I think Anita said that's not the most pleasant task. I've done it sure. myself, and I still Beans. Do when there's mm-hmm. a problem I need to address.
Let me get a call here from Iowa. Might be good for you, Rob. Keith in Paulina, Iowa. Keith, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a farmer from Northwest Iowa. I've joined the farm with my family. I'm third generation, and we haven't experienced, I'd say, a problem on our farm anyway with Roundup resistance. But like the previous comments, we try to make sure we balance rotation chemicals. And I feel, you know, we get blamed for the dead spot in the Gulf with soil runoff. And as a farmer, it's in our best interest to maintain the farm to its best ability through new practices like no-till. And to achieve no-till requires chemistry.
Right.
And, you know, that also then we use manure. And we get accused large animal production
right.
is a big cause. And it just is always a conflict. And, you know, government programs like CRP, waterway conservation, Iowa State's done a lot of interesting things on how much soil runoff is collected with waterways, you know, giving money to farmers for that, helping us, we'll adapt. That's exactly what we'll do.
But Keith, do you think you're going to be able to keep up no-till, no-plow farming if Roundup's effectiveness decreases and you need to turn that soil over to kill off some of that weed population?
Well, and we do that in responsible ways by trying to make sure we till right before the planter, or maybe limit our fall tillage.
Yeah.
You know, allowing corn stalk coverage to be there. But it goes back to diversifying. We have to have multiple methods to try to achieve our goals, to not allow one thing to overtake. And so far, I would say in our area, for the most part, my neighbors and I, we're achieving that. You know, we're spraying right now today, Roundup, as we speak.
Yeah,
and we've applied other chemicals and products that allow it to get the plant and stick and hold better. To, you know, have effectiveness, because you need to be effective. If the plant is 2 feet tall, you're going to create resistance there. That's it, same with antibiotics. We try to make sure you always limit that, because you know it's all a factor. We have to make sure we diversify.
Use too much, and evolution's going to find a way around you. Keith, I appreciate your work there and your call. Doug in Washington, I wonder what you're thinking as you know, Keith feels kind of besieged here by complaints about the way the farming gets done, and yet he's out there and has to be effective.
Right. Well, and I think farmers, you know, do the best they can and want to do the right thing, you know, for both the environment, and they have a business to run. So, you know, there's a lot of competing interests there. What he said about, you know, rotating crops, it was hard to tell if he was talking about rotating chemicals or rotating crops.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the data really show that we're not rotating crops nearly as much as we should be. You know, about half of the crops we grow are corn and soybeans.
A lot of that's also related to Roundup. And, I mean, I've got neighbors who don't do it anymore because they've got fertilizer and they've got Roundup. You don't need to.
Don't need to grow the other crops?
To rotate the crops, even between corn and soybeans sometimes.
You do need to. I mean, that's why we're developing these problems, because we're not using good biological principles. And, you know, so going back to – it's not really going back. I mean, some of those things were done before, but I think it's really a misconception to equate – new technology and new knowledge, new science, only with chemicals and genetic engineering. Conventional breeding is actually doing better than genetic engineering, both for developing things like drought tolerance. Mm. You know, for every trait that's been developed through genetic engineering, we have literally 10 that are still being developed through conventional breeding more cheaply and probably just as quickly. So a big part of the problem, though, we have to remember, is not just... you know, what's happening on the ground, but our policies and what our policies do to encourage certain types of agriculture. Our subsidy system and subsidizing biofuels, for example, are encouraging planting more corn for ethanol,
mm-hmm.
and because of the subsidies that will back the farmers up. There have been some interesting studies that have shown that without those subsidies, these longer crop rotations become much more profitable. And I think it's important to point out, just as productive. I want to go back, though, to a point about this whole idea about feeding the world and the increasing population. In many other countries, as was pointed out before, the labor issue is not the same in the U.S. Most of the population in many parts of the world are farmers. And you know, in those areas, what are really needed and what have been shown through UN studies, through a huge study similar to the big climate change study, an international study with hundreds of scientists called the IAASTD, was supported by the World Bank. Dozens of countries signed off on it. What their recommendation was to use these agroecological principles because it's been shown that they work better and more cheaply than some of the supposed high-tech solutions in developing countries, where we really need to help have farmers be able to better feed themselves.
Can you double food production in 40 years, as the UN, Rob reports the UN is projecting the need?
Well, the many of these agroecological systems, and there's some big UN studies, UN Development Program, UN Environment Program, and others, have shown the capability with these systems of, you know, often doubling or more than doubling yields. And in the U.S., I think it's very important to remember that these other systems are quite capable of producing yields comparable to what we're producing now, these longer rotations. And there have been some huge studies even on organic that they can be as productive. The labor issue here is certainly an issue and is going to take time to reverse. But the current way we're doing agriculture is not encouraging that labor situation because it's encouraging farms to get bigger and bigger.
Rob, what are you thinking as you hear Doug's perspective on this and you hear from our caller in Pauline, Iowa, who feels a little beaten up as he tries to do the right thing and bring in the crop?
Well, one thing I'd like your listeners to realize is in a 20-year time period from 1987 to 2007, I'm just going to talk about soybeans. Soybeans decreased soil loss in this country by 31% per acre, decreased energy needs by 38%, more or less maintained the same water usage, and at the same time increased our yields by 20%.
Now, Roundup was a big part of that. You didn't have to drive across cultivating so much. You didn't have to plow, so you weren't losing the topsoil.
And that's exactly right. That's the listener from Iowa mentioned that. We still farmers still use limited tillage when it's appropriate. So I think they have to realize, I mean, I really like producing food. I think most people want to produce food in the United States, and I think that's the key here. We can do this with the modern technology, modern tools. And some of it is genetically enhanced, some of it is natural breeding, and some of it is using different chemistries. I think most producers, most listeners are well served by that.
You know, you can hear, though, a lot of listeners today really wanting something substantially more organic, being quite skeptical about the chemical side of the equation. And, of course, we know about the complaints about genetic modification. How much organic can you pull into an operation like yours, Rob?
Well, I think organic's a great option, and I really encourage people, if they have that desire, and I encourage producers to fill that need in the marketplace. I think that's a good option, and I do think you have to realize it does increase the cost, and producers and consumers will have to pay more for organic. I think that's a great option. I encourage people to address it in the marketplace.
Rob Joslin, joining us today from Yellow Springs, Ohio, president of the American Soybean Association. Thank you very much, Rob, for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephanie is calling. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air in Tennessee.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'd just like to point out that I think the American consumers just aren't aware of what's going on with our food. I'm the mother of a 7-year-old who's diagnosed with eosinophilic disorder 2 years ago.
Okay.
Up until that point, I didn't really know or care really where my food came from. In the last 2 years, I've done a lot of investigation on it, and I really feel like there's something with our food that's caused all these strange food allergy problems with our children. And I think if more parents were aware of it, they would be more than willing to pay for the price of organic food.
Stephanie, I'm sorry for the trouble your son's having. Anita, what do you think of Stephanie's concern?
I completely agree that we need more education on how we do our farming. Most people are, if you know, a family farm, acreage that they're managing within their families, that they are trying to be as sustainable as possible. Maybe it's not organic, but they're trying to be as sustainable and produce foods for the American public. And I appreciate that she's learned more about what we're trying to do when we're producing our food. But potentially there are challenges in the food allergies. We're realizing that there's a lot of different foods out there, different things that we produce, that sometimes we don't know what all the ramifications are, but we keep trying to be as sustainable as possible and producing the best food that's out there.
We're likely to hear more about 2,4-D coming back. You said earlier that that's not related to Agent Orange, but the news clippings are full of that, that Agent Orange is dioxin and 2,4-D. Is that not right?
It is a mix of the two, mm-hmm. but it's the dioxin side that's the problem side. Mm-hmm. 2,4-D really hasn't been an issue. I know Doug mentioned something about them being endocrine disruptors. These products were introduced, sort of our first herbicides that are out there that are effective on controlling broadleafs and grass crops. And so, again, a judicious use, a rotation use, awareness of how to use these products in the right place with just the right amount allows us to still get rid of the weeds and manage them correctly. Again, it's not as it's still a herbicide. It's still something you need to think about and be concerned about, but not as extreme as Agent Orange.
Well, it's a real education for us today, and we're grateful to each of you for helping us get it. Anita Dilley at Kansas State University joining us today from Lawrence, Kansas. Thank you so much for being here, Professor Dilley.
You're welcome.
And Doug Urian-Sherman with the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington. Doug, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A program note before we go, I will be talking tonight in Boston with the outspoken middle-class champion and TARP overseer, Elizabeth Warren, about regulatory reform in American finance. We'll be broadcasting that conversation tomorrow. If you have questions you'd like to put to Elizabeth Warren, share them now at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.